Ben, let me break and see if everybody's back. Over to you, Dick.
I can tell that Eric thinks that he's going to find a replacement oven for me. Outer dimension of the oven has a width of 22 inches. The height I can live with all kinds of height, but I can't go beyond 22 inches of width of the outer dimension of the oven, which is mounted in a hole in the wall, which is not quite 21 inches wide. It's got a lip on each side that covers up the hole, if you know what I mean. So it's a 21-inch hole in the wall, 22-inch wide, outer dimension of the oven. After quite a lot of searches, I have not found a substitute for that one. I wonder if you got that error. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ, I'm busy looking at this thing. I got a bunch of questions for you, and yes, I do think that that can be turned into an effective model.
Okay, figure three, with all of its holes and crazy outer dimensions and bent, it's actually bent around a cylindrical object, so to speak, and that in turn gets injection molded. If you look at the later figure numbers, you'll see what it starts looking like with injection molding and how it gets attached to the scent, to the front end of the handheld with pistol grip actual RFID interrogator. So that particular antenna has bandwidth performance that's many times what else is available in the world of antennas on interrogators. It's a hell of a lot higher in gain and a hell of a lot wider in bandwidth and a hell of a lot lower in VISWAR, so that CW radar doesn't jam its own receiver. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Don't forget, I didn't say that doing that would be a fast thing, but what you have in your head being translated into something effective is something that can be done pretty reasonably. I'm just curious about the feed points. I see this nice little slot. Looks like kind of like a cameraman to me a little bit. It is a very unique looking device, is it not? And I like the way that it's in the later figures, the way they have it wrapped around.
Yeah, the actual feed point, when you see that feed point diagram, the right-hand little perturbation is where the center conductor goes, and the left-hand side is where the shield goes. The shield goes to what you and I would call the boom of the antenna, and the center conductor goes to what you and I would call the gamma rod, but it doesn't have a capacitor to it. It's a gamma rod without a capacitor. The capacitor is made electronically by adjusting the reactance of the resonance of the driven element. And by the way, the picture that you see there is the 95% picture. There was a further innovation that went on further downrange where the performance was improved a little bit more by the width of the boom between the driven element and the first director was made considerably wider. And you would think that would just be shorting out the signal. Well, it gave a huge improvement, because this whole antenna wanted to be 2 inches further from front to back. But the industrial designers wouldn't permit that. Therefore, the director is too close, therefore it's too tightly coupled to the driven element. By making the boom out of sheet metal wider, it decreased the coupling between driven element and first director, and you got most of the performance back, even though the spacing was way too short. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Just out of curiosity, have you tried to do any kind of mathematical analysis of the finished product? In essence, what do you call it? A Venn diagram? It's not a Venn diagram. Whereas actually you would, in a physical or schematic way, show where the inductances and the capacitances are, and relate that to the actual math that makes it work.
No, that was not done, and I'm reasonably sure that approach would not lead to a result that you desire. This was modeled by this guy I told you with a doctorate degree in antenna design, with 25 years of experience. experience at the Naval Research Laboratory in Rhode Island.
I'm asking if you did. I don't care about the other guy. I mean, you know, it's nice to know when you make something to figure out why it works.
Okay. When you've got a device like that that is so distributed, you're going to try to model it with L's and C's and R's, mostly L's and C's. It would take a very large array of them. And by the way, have you ever seen Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the so-called equation that supposedly predicts the impedance of a dipole? Have you ever seen that equation, Eric?
Not in a long time, but I have.
You'd be amazed how many people who have fallen into the trap, the minefield trap, of using that equation with computer modeling. Everyone forgets the paragraph that's right alongside of the equation saying that this works only within a couple of percent of the resonant frequency of a half-wave-like dipole. The equation is quite complicated, even though it's been overly simplified, and it does a poor job of modeling only close in, and you go far in frequency, and the equation doesn't work. And everyone wants to believe that equation is a derivation. It's not. It's a curve-fitting attempt. It's the equivalent of a cubic spline trying to fit the Brown and Woodward curves, and it only fits the Brown and Woodward curves within a couple of percent of resonance. A simple little dipole. What's really going on in there is a hell of a lot more complicated than meets the eye. And if you make the dipole super wide, as I have in this case, and put it closely coupled to a director and a reflector that's also super wide, and all of them are in an exotic shape, you try to model that with L's and C's. And I don't think there's enough L's and C's in the world to do that. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
You've just stuck in your head. Actually, the person that turned that into a modeling program should have read that last paragraph and included it in his program. You know, whatever you make in terms of a modeling program is only as good as the parameters that you create for it. If you're of a singular mindset and don't necessarily have any desire to expand it, then, you know, say what you say. But, you can take something that you know works because you're making thousands of them and actually start to analyze what the parameters are that actually make it work and build a program that understands that, that represents that, and that works within a given set of parameters that you've created. If you want to expand the parameters, that's another story. It means you have to create some more input. You have to find out what the real world is going to do to you. I mean, don't forget, you're really doing a discovery of nature. What nature provides to you, you have to tap and find it. You know, sometimes the math is not apparent because, you know, the traditional math that you use doesn't work the way you want it to. But once you discover what the secret is that nature does, you can turn that into math. K2RIW, KJJ.
You're saying some very logical words, Eric. It is my belief that there are roughly 5,000 kinds of antennas in the world. The Antenna Engineering Handbook, the Bible of the subject, is now in its fifth edition, starting in roughly 1960, I think it was. So here we are, 5 editions downrange. It's now a 1,200-page book, 5,000 kinds of antennas. Every one of those antennas, somewhere in it, has the equivalent of a dipole that starts launching the signal, whether it's the monopole that feeds your waveguide to coax adapter inside of a horn, whether it's the driven element, there's a dipole somewhere. Dipole, dipole, dipole. It's the most basic reproduced antenna on planet Earth. Here we are 150 years downrange from Maxwell. You would think somebody has created a reasonable equation telling you just the impedance of a dipole as a function of diameter, length, and frequency. It doesn't exist. 150 years downrange, a zillion guys are trying, lots and lots of books on the subject. I can buy books that will tell you a huge, great big spreadsheet of this is what we measure. There is no equation that I know of that models it beyond a few percent around the resonant frequency. Mother Nature on that simple-looking device is doing something a hell of a lot more complicated than first meets the eye. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
You know, we can talk about this all night.
Yeah.
You just put the quotes around within a couple of percent of the resonant frequency. And you can incorporate that into any program and say that, you know, this only works here. But basically, it's going to give you the same answer as if you worked it out on paper. I don't know if anyone has actually bothered to say, okay, let's find out what happens when we hit the point where it doesn't work anymore. And you've got to ask yourself, is that antenna effective, since you want to use it where that formula doesn't work, et cetera, so on and so forth. There's a lot of ways you can go with that. I hear what you're saying, okay? But that doesn't mean we can't still discover the answer. K2RW, K2EJ.
Even when you discover that answer, Eric, are you sure that that is a better approach than the one that I'm advocating? The one that I'm advocating gives you an amount of visibility that you wouldn't believe. The answer is on that screen in real time, 30 frames per second. You can't see the flicker. To the human response of moving something around, it looks like there is absolutely no delay.
I'm gonna not argue with that point, okay? Not everybody has a VNA. Sometimes math is a little bit an easier tool. You know, and if you create the math that helps other people out, well, that's a good thing.
You and I, if you want a VNA bad enough, you can buy it as a dongle that you plug into your laptop these days, Eric.
Yes, I know. I happen to own one. Yes, I agree. And yes, the hands-on approach is the best way to learn something. There's no question about that. I tend to also think a little bit about the commercial world, where is it? Does every person have to reinvent the wheel? Can't they have a little help to get them zeroed in? Maybe they just need to tune it up once they get there.
Now, from everything you and I have said and everyone has listened to tonight, you were led to believe that when it comes to computer modeling and equations, that I have no faith in it. Absolutely not. I'm now going to give you an example. Paul, a week or two or 3 weeks ago, told us about the NASA site we can go to. And you go to the NASA site, it tells you what Goldstone is doing, what Canberra is doing, what Spain is doing, the 230-foot dishes and the 185-foot dishes and the 60-foot dishes that NASA has that's monitoring all of those spacecraft. You go to that website, and as I did that at midnight last night, and what were they doing? They were listening to the downlink of Voyager number 2, okay? They gave me the exact signal strength, minus 153.44 dBm is what they were receiving. 160 bits per second was the downlink rate. Voyager number 2 at the time was 16.58 billion kilometers away. That's 110.83 astronomical units, 10.30 billion miles. Let me drop. My faith in calculating free space loss is such that, okay, I took that distance. I know the exact frequency they're using. They told me 8.56 is at gigahertz. Where did I write that down? Anyhow, I knew the exact frequency. I knew the exact range to the nearest fraction of a mile out of billions of miles. So I knew exactly what the free space loss is. 315.35 dB. 315.35 dB is the free space loss. NASA has told me that the Voyager number 2 has a 12-foot parabolic dish on side on it, 3.66 meters diameter. That's 12.0 feet diameter. I know the exact gain of a well-tuned parabolic dish antenna of that wavelength at that frequency. And that antenna has a gain of, where the hell is the number here? 47.95. The antenna's got 47.95 dB of gain, 0.682 degrees of beamwidth. In other words, plus or minus 3/10 of a degree of misaiming of Voyager number 2, plus or minus 3/10 of a degree, the signal would be 3 dB down. They got to aim that to the nearest 1/10 of a degree continuously during the downlink transmission. So that antenna's got 47.95 dB of gain, 12-foot diameter. Let me drop. NASA's Goldstone dish, but it wasn't Goldstone, it was Canberra that was listening at that time. They told you the wind. wind speed, the azimuth, the elevation, and you watch the numbers slowly turn, slowly change, because the Earth is rotating while they're looking at this fixed object out there in space. So you watch the numbers change, but the 230-foot dish of Goldstone, it's giving them high performance. It's got 73.6 dB of gain. It's got a 0.035 degree deep width. 0.035 degrees. Has to be extremely accurately aimed. You better make sure you're listening on a non-windy day. So, you know that you got 73.60 dB of gain in the Canberra dish, the 230-foot diameter dish, the 70-meter dish. You know you've got 47.95 dB of gain on the Voyager dish. You know that the signal strength is minus 153.44 dB. You know the free space loss is 315.35 dB because of the 110 astronomical units. You put that all together, you now know the exact power output of Voyager in order to make that signal strength happen. The answer is 10.85 watts. 10.84. Voyager is now putting out 10.84 watts out of that traveling wave tube, and in order to make all those numbers come out right. I'm kind of amazed that it came out so good when you've got those huge ranges, these huge dishes. Everything has to be aimed just right, and you get very close. I'll bet you the real watts output was plus or minus a fraction of a watt from that calculation. Here we are, 37 years downrange. Let me drop.
Question?
Okay, we'll get your question in a minute. We're 37 years downrange. The thing that's moving away from us at something like 40,000 miles an hour. It's out there three times the distance to Pluto, 110.83 astronomical units. And it comes out so simple if you understand a couple of basic principles of RF propagation. You know, the exact free space loss. You know the exact gain of the transmitting antenna. Assume that they tuned it correctly, and I know damn well they did. They've got lots of years of use and a lot of megabucks involved. They've tuned that dish on both the transmitting dish on Voyager and the receiving dish at Canberra in this particular case. A few hours later is probably going to be Goldstone in California. Anyhow, so you put the numbers together, and you know exactly what power output that transmitter on Voyager had to do to make that happen. That, by the way, is the power received at the dish after the feed line loss. Go ahead, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
Do Earth's atmospherics contribute to that loss factor, or are they negligible and not part of the equation? I'm just trying to understand it. You're talking about a path loss in free space with no air, but does the Earth's atmosphere add to this, or how does that change that?
Yeah, Canberra in Australia is essentially a desert. Goldstone in California, I've been there. It is a desert. Is it part of the Mojave? Yeah, it's part of the Mojave Desert. So the air is as dry as you're going to get in both locations. 8.5 gigs, you get very little air insertion loss. A tenth of a dB type stuff. If you had a raging hurricane, yes, two things would happen. The dish would be waving back and forth. You couldn't keep it aimed precisely. And all that water in there would give you some extra loss. But the first water major absorption is at 22 gigahertz. 8.4 gigs was carefully chosen because it's the bottom of the so-called bathtub curve. If you look at the insertion loss of atmosphere, ionosphere, the works, it's a bathtub shred curve, and the bottom of that bathtub is around 8.4 gigs. Very carefully chosen. Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
Okay, nothing else.
Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Have a member on EchoLink that would like you to repeat the manufacturer of the stove you're talking about. I think you said it was well-built.
That's Big Ten for everybody. Yes, well-built. W-E-L-B-I-L-T. And that range, correction, the oven, is 22 inches wide outer dimension, and it's mounted in a hole in the wall that's a little bit under 21 inches wide. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, maybe they were going to look something up or chase it for you. I don't know, but thanks for answering the question.
Yeah, maybe I didn't do a thorough enough search, but on a number of occasions I've done as much search as I thought I could do that's reasonable on the internet, and nobody makes a ring. range that narrow for a kitchen. I was hoping somebody would make a range that's narrow intended for a recreation vehicle. And no, I can't find it anywhere. When Whale Boat went out of business, they just took that design and threw it away. Took all those spare parts and threw them away. They weren't going to make them available to me.
Yeah, Dick, I believe they start at like 24 now and go to increments like 30 and 36 and 42. Strange, but yeah, that's an odd size.
That's the way DJ with some info.
Okay, go ahead, Dave. You found a range for me? You found an oven for me, yeah, Dave? Hot stuff. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I'll send you a couple of links. There's a company that makes ranges specifically for RVs. I think they're propane ranges, but they're 21 inches wide, they call them.
Yeah, but I'm not looking for a range. I'm looking for an oven. I'm looking for an oven, Dave. Go ahead.
All right, you want a stove, right? A stove top with burners on the top?
Negative. Oven. I want to cook a cake. I want to cook a turkey. That's going to go in an oven. Over to you, Dave.
Oh, Dick, you're talking about a wall oven.
Roger. A wall oven.
I think we're talking about a range. Okay.
All right, I'll send you this link anyway. You take a look. I think it has both. I think it has stove top burners, and then it has an oven underneath it. So. All right, whatever. That's your APG.
Yeah, my crazy kitchen has the oven on one wall and the range on another wall. They're completely separate items. And the oven is a very tall, narrow thing, 22 inches wide, outer dimension, 21 inches is the hole in the wall that it's mounted in. So, I wonder if you're a little bit as surprised as I am, Paul, that I've been making a rough mental guess that traveling wave tube on Voyager is down to around 6 watts. Looks like it's really putting out 10.4 watts. And you calculate the 160 bits per second, they're getting something like 12 dB of carrier noise ratio. I know what bit error rate they're getting on the stuff they're listening to. And 3 times the distance to Pluto. And counting. And I think you told us that they're likely to keep listening to those two spacecraft up until the year 2022, if not later. Boy, I mean, let me drop it. That to me is the most beautiful demonstration of a philosophy of RF that I've had for lots and lots of years. You transmit an RF signal on any frequency you want, in any direction you want. It's going to every single cubic centimeter of this total universe with multipath. It's going everywhere. It never goes to complete zero anywhere. And if you got the right kind of equipment, like a 230-foot dish with a low-noise Mesa amplifier in the front end, probably with a 10-degree Kelvin equivalent noise temperature, and you've got a satellite with a 12-foot dish doing the transmitting, you can easily accomplish that distance. The round-trip time is 1.28 days, 30.72 hours on Voyager number 2, round trip time, at the speed of light. That's really pushing the numbers all the way. WS2N, KQI, W, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, it is, and there's two spacecraft out there, both of them probably pushing about the same amount of watts. An interview with Ed Stone. He was a project manager originally when they took off, and still is today. So went from a young fellow to an older guy, and he's still at it. But in that interview, he did say it was 24 watts. That was a couple of years ago. So maybe it dropped off significantly since then. I don't know what happened. Very good. That website, if I knew the emergency was, going to happen or happening at the time for Kepler last week, I would have gone to that website and, you would have seen the communications between the Deep Space Network and Kepler.
Yeah, hold on a minute now. When Stone is talking about the watts of the transmitter, he, as a spacecraft designer, is telling you about watts input to the power supply of that transmitter. He might not be talking about power output of that transmitter being delivered to the antenna feed horn. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, that makes sense. He says, you know, they're producing 24 watts to transmit. So, you know, I guess he's concerned about his onboard power. You know, they keep shutting things down on those spacecraft. They shut down cameras decades ago, and some of the science equipment that they don't need anymore, the heaters that are not necessary anymore, they shut those down. They need to conserve power because the RTGs are eventually, losing about, I think they're 4% a year or something like that, capability. Not so much the RTGs, but the thermocouples that they're tied into. You know, they produce heat with the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, and that heats these thermocouples, which are hundreds of them in series and in parallel to generate their power. They're all wrapped in like graphite blankets, and they get hot. So yeah, that's probably what he's talking about. But the website itself is good. It would have shown the emergency situation with Kepler.
At one point, I'm going to give you when you get a chance. Back to you, Paul.
Okay. Kepler is in orbit behind Earth, following Earth around the Sun. So it's in a heliocentric orbit about 77 million miles back and drifting slowly further, you know, as the years go on. It was only launched, I think, 2000 or in probably, it was 7 or so. Maybe 9. I think 2009, I think, was launched. I'll have to check. But it's not all that old, Kepler. But it's failed. It's on this life support system. It's, and they call it K2 now. It's doing a different mission than what it was originally intended to. It completely went into an emergency situation last week. I think we talked about that. But now it's recovered. Your initial reports I heard didn't look good. Apparently, whatever has gone wrong, they're able to get around it. And I haven't heard the exact report of what went wrong, but they're out of the emergency mode. When they do that, all spacecraft, Cassini and Voyager, they all get cut off. All the attention goes to the emergency spacecraft until they can either bring it back to life or write it off. Similar to what happened to the telescope launched by Japan. That's a total failure, by the way. I think I talked about that one a couple of months ago. That thing has spun out of control. Parts have flown off of it, and that's the end of that. That was the X-ray telescope that Japan had launched.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We're going to time it out. WS1.
Yeah, very briefly. Not a real problem. Voyager is, according to my calculation, Voyager number 2, transmitting a downlink of plus 40.35 dBm, which is 10.84 watts downlink from Voyager. When NASA talks up to Voyager, I think the answer is 10,000 watts of transmission, as opposed to 10 watts. 10 watts down, 10,000 watts up, I think. I'm not sure. I didn't confirm that. But by that website, we should be able to confirm. And by the way, when they talk to it and when they listen to it are not the same. You can talk to it for a full day, and a day and a fraction later, you start getting the answer, and you might not be transmitting anymore. You've already sent your message because of that huge delay. Let me drop it. But I am guessing the uplink power is something like 10,000 watts. And even though, and the trans- 230 feet in diameter. Seems crazy. The biggest dish with the highest gain is transmitting the most power. The smaller dish with the smaller gain is transmitting the least power. How come? Well, when it comes to the insertion loss between two dishes, which one is big and which one's small doesn't matter. The gains add, the free space loss is there, and you subtract one set of numbers from the other, and that's the loss you get from dish to dish. Whether you're transmitting or receiving, it doesn't matter, because of reciprocity. So why the hell does the uplink power have to be roughly 1,000 times higher? And that's because the downlink receiver at the Canberra is a Macer, or a cryogenically cooled low noise amplifier front end with probably 10 degrees Kelvin. Let me drop. It's a super sensitive cryogenic receiver. Voyager doesn't have that kind of a receiver. You can put that kind of a gas-fed preamplifier on there if you're crazy enough to do it. And in the process of launching it, a little bit of a lightning strike come along, wipes out the front end of your gas fed, and now you got nothing. That receiver on Voyager has got to be simple. I am guessing it's an extremely simple mixer front end with no RF preamplifier. Way back in 1937, they didn't have any nice, compact, field effect transistor, 8.4 gigahertz, low noise amplifiers of high reliability that are space qualified. 1937 didn't have that. It's a simple mixer diode front end. It probably has a 10 decibel noise figure after the filtering and everything else that goes on. Whereas the receiver at Goldstone probably has a noise figure of a tenth of a dB, whereas the receiver on Voyager probably has a noise figure of 10 dB. If you just count the dBs, divide one into the other, it's a 100-to-1 ratio. You can't do that with dBs. But if you did, a tenth of a dB versus 10 dB is are the two noise figures. Rough numbers. Crazy mathematics. Ain't that the Paul? WS2N, K2IW. Oh, one other thing. The original K1 mission of Voyager, of Kepler, with its inertial wheels, was looking into a very specific direction that had been very carefully chosen to maximize the mission of finding exoplanets. After the failure of those inertial wheels, and now you're using the other technique for the K2 mission, I believe they're looking in an entirely different direction, and I'm not sure the direction remains constant all year round as it circles the sun with us. But I think it's a very different direction where they're now looking with the K2 mission. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, they're following the orbit of the Earth, so similar to what, you know, when we go out stargazing, you know, in the wintertime we'll see Orion, and in the summertime, the sky will look different. Because we're looking at a different part of the zodiacs. Kepler's doing the same thing. So, in fact, that's what they were doing. They're coming around part of the sun, and they wanted to change the location, and they wanted to point toward. They wanted to point toward the center of the galaxy, because they were coming up to it or going away from it. Whatever, they were making a change, and it was not 180 degrees, but almost 180 degrees from facing forward to facing backward, actually the other way around. It was facing toward the back, looking at dark sky, but then they wanted to bring it forward. And in that process, they started getting erroneous reports from Kepler. So, it's being balanced by, it doesn't have solar wings. It's just got solar body all around it. It's like if you took a telescope, let's say it would be around a thermos bottle, and you put it inside of a milk carton, and then that milk carton is the shape of Kepler. You take one side off, you know what I mean? Now you take one of those 90-degree portions of that milk carton and balance it toward the sun, have the solar probably didn't have big, long solar panels because they probably wanted to avoid that type of thing when it was initially put up there. And you're right, they were always pointing to one point in the sky, actually pointing towards Cygnus. And I think with the big solar panels, it would have moved it too much, and they wanted to control it with the reaction wheels. Well, that didn't work out. Dick, over to you. KQRIWWS.
Give us a few words, Paul, now that the reaction wheels are not there in operating condition on Kepler, and they still, in order to do this exoplanet search, have to do something like looking into one particular direction for a reasonable length of time, some number of days. So the orientation is no longer taking place by reaction wheels. What's the real mechanism by which they control and steer the orientation now? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Well, the two reaction wheels are still working. It went up with four, and one quit, and then the other one died. So now they have two, and this balancing act with the sun's rays, that's, I guess, acting as the third. Because they did say in the statement when it was in the emergency mode, it's probably another failed reaction wheel, and if that's the case, the mission would be over. So they're looking at different closer star systems as they go around, where the K1 was staring at this one spot in the sky, looking at 100,000 stars at one time. And getting all their information, and from that they extrapolate, you know, basically the whole universe of how many planets we really have, and that's what they were doing. But this is going around looking at closer in stars and star systems, and actually taking that data and looking for some good, real good candidates for James Webb to look at when that goes up in 2018.
The emergency this week, you probably explained it, and I missed some of that because of the running around I was doing. Did they get a reasonable recovery from that emergency this week, Paul? Are they back in operation? They thought one more inertial wheel failed, but it did not. Repeat a couple of those words for me, Paul, for the S2N, K2RIW.
Yes, yeah, you're right. Last week was we reported it was in the emergency mode, and that happened, I think, the day before the net, and then now, this week, I'm reporting that it's back in operation. They're actually putting it back into science mode. I just haven't found any website that confirms what went wrong with it. They have recovered it. They have control over it. Sending back good data, and I believe it's by tonight it's probably back in the science mode, looking at star systems, staring at the. It's not really a telescope on board. It's a photo meter, really looking at the lightness, the star, and looking for planets going in front of it. But it is back in operation, from what I understand. I just don't know the actual cause. Maybe they don't know yet. I can't confirm that. With all the data they get back, it does send housekeeping reports on how it's doing as part of the telemetry. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think they pronounced that photometer. A photometer is the optical equivalent of a RF radiometer. In either case, you're looking at the amount of power flux density that you get from a particular direction. You're looking at a bazillion of stars. You're now deciding that particular pixel is looking at my favorite star. And as that star makes an extremely small change in the power output from your point of view, because a planet has passed in front of it, and that planet passes in front of it, makes the power output go down and come back up again with an extremely well-defined characteristic curve. And that curve tells you a lot of information. How big is the planet? How big is the orbit of the planet? Is the planet an elliptical orbit? Circular orbit? In some cases, if there's an atmosphere on that planet, let me drop it. You know what the spectral output of the star is, and as now with the planet in front of the star, some of that solar light is looking through that atmosphere. That atmosphere is filtering that light, and certain characteristic lines of oxygen, hydrogen, argon, whatever, certain lines get sucked out to a small degree. And so, in some cases, you're actually measuring the constituents and the thickness of the atmosphere that's on the planet that's passing in front of that particular star just by doing a specific radiometry experiment, a photometry experiment, a spectral photometry is what it really is. You're looking at individual spectral lines, individual portions of various wavelengths, let's call it, and how much those individual lines move up and down in amplitude, with what timing, as that planet passes in front. Beautiful system, that Kepler. Let me drop it. Now, James Webb is going to be able to do some of that work, particularly with infrared emphasis. But Kepler itself, if Hubble is arguably the most productive piece of space hardware that we maybe have ever launched, Kepler, I'm going to guess, is the second most productive piece of space hardware. To your knowledge, with either European or the United States Space Agency, is there a replacement to Kepler on the way other than that particular function being done by James Webb? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, as far as I know, there's nothing identical to it being planned. In fact, I was going to say that they should duplicate that, just make another one, make it a little bit better, be a little careful with these reaction wheels, and put it up into space. I don't think it was all that expensive, but it's such a successful project. I don't see why they just don't start working on another one. I mean, they got the blueprints. They know what went wrong. And they, you know, the first one, you know, lasted a couple of years, and it went on a fritz. Build another one that's going to last longer. I don't get it. Not that I know of. I know they got other ones tests planned, and a couple of other telescopes. WFIRST planned big money telescopes. They should put up another Kepler. I agree. Well, I don't have anything else here, Dick. I mean, there's plenty of rockets that are going to be going up in the near future. I mean, Dick? Sort of about the Chinese program, the Indian space program. But we're going to run out of time. Back over to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
We got John and at least one other person. Go right ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, you know, it's amazing. You would think, Paul, that they're going to use these reaction wheels in the future. Why wouldn't they be mounting a major project to get those things figured out? What's going wrong with them? We've had a few issues. I'm sure that's an ongoing event. Maybe you know more. Back to you. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I've never seen one actually in person, so, you know, I understand pretty much the operation of them. They have been successful. They've used them for a lot of different spacecraft. I mean, Cassini's got it in orbit around Saturn with no problem. That thing was launched in 2004. Around Saturn, which was probably launched in 7 years before, right? So, probably 1997. And that was successful. Ulysses went around the sun, polar orbit, with reaction wheels. I think most of them have done pretty good. So I don't know. Maybe they got a bad batch. John, I had one question before. Before it gets any later for you. Let me drop it. I was going to send another article into the Limoch Tech website, and I want to put on, you know, got my call letters. I got Dick put his on, you know, for the TechNet. I wanted to put yours on, if that's okay. Rather check with you before I do that. Maybe your email or something for contacts. Back to you, John.
Yes, Paul, by all means. Yeah, I think you have the website. You've sent me stuff before. My email address is listed on QRZ, if not. Yeah, you can put that in there. No problem. Be glad to hear it. Be glad to get it.
I had a crazy feeling this week about something. As you guys know, there's a picture of me I call the selfie picture. Top-down picture. I have mounted a camera on an arm off the side of my tower, 20 feet above me. And a 20-foot-long air release goes into my hand. And I climb down the tower, look up at the camera, and flip the camera. And you guys have seen that picture. I'll bet you some of the people who listen to the TechNet would love to see a picture of John and Paul, if you guys are willing to do that. And I guarantee Mike with number two would put that on his website. So over to you first on that one, now, Paul. WS2N, T2RIW.
I'm in a QST, let's see, 1995, I think. what is it? Probably June. I'll have to go double check. That's an old picture. Back to you, Dick, and then over to John.
Yeah, 1995 is 21 years old, and you may have changed a little bit since then. You may have gotten more handsome. Are you willing to put a picture John? Because the thing that's always been amazing to me is lots of people like Paul and John and others who I've talked to a zillion times on ham radio, and I've got a mental picture of what you guys look like. Well, I've met Paul face-to-face. I expected a tall, Nordic-looking, you know, blonde hair, blue-eyed guy, and not quite. John, do you look like... John, do you think you look anything like my mental image I've got of you? KC2WGB, KJYW.
Oh, I doubt it. Probably more vampire-ish. By the way, Dick, I did send you a picture, it's quite a few years ago, of me flying a multi-engine. I sent that over to you along with the trash suit picture, I believe. But I will get a picture that is suitable for, not framing, but it will have a good description. I'll get that out, and we'll get that posted. That's a good idea.
And do you have a more modern picture than 21 years old, Paul, of S2NKJRIW? You don't have to do this. This is a gentle request. No one is demanding it. But it would add a little bit more personality to Mike 1 and Mike 2's website. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, but you're a little dot on that that antenna. No, I don't. I got plenty of pictures, of course. But thinking back to 1995, I guess it was 95. And I was, because I duplicated exactly homebrew 2-element 10-meter beam that some guy put together, and his instructions were, you know, in QST. So I duplicated exactly what this guy had, big beam, threw it on top of the rotator and worked pretty good for 2 meters, for 10 meters. So I sent that picture in and don't print anything. Back to you, Dick.
Most of the radio communication we do terrestrially on Earth, between the transmitter and receiver, you got some free space loss of 80, 90, 100, 110, 120 dB, numbers like that. But when you're out there at what is it now? 110.83 astronomical units for Voyager 2, which is a close one, and you get 315.35 dB. Think about that. $63 million were spent on arguably one of the world's best anechoic chambers out at Edwards Air Force Base. And I worked in that chamber in 1989, 1990. 300 foot square, an acre and a half of floor space with a ceiling 7 stories high. Tempest-proof 100 dB. So this chamber, where the walls are a quarter of an inch thick steel plate, all the steel plates carefully welded together to make sure there's no bubble in the welds. They're all Magnaflux or something like that. Let me drop. So the world's best shielded chamber, where any signal from the outside world to the inside world of the chamber is 100 dB down, 10 billion to 1 power ratio. That's a 100 dB tempest-proof chamber. $63 million worth, done by Rockwell. And the free space loss between Voyager and us is not 100 dB, not 200 dB, 315 dB. If you built that $63 million chamber 3 times in a row and put one inside the other, you still wouldn't have that amount of loss. I mean, the 100 dB is 10 billion to 1. To put it as a real number of ratio, 315 dB, I can't even figure what that's going to be. That's a lot of loss. That's a lot of distance. And that signal still gets there, and that signal doesn't get tired. Radio works. You just have to use the right equipment. Radio works. There is no distance that can't be spanned with radio. You may not like the time delay, but that radio signal gets there. Okay, this was TechNet number 1,598. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. Go easy with each other. I mean, this is a hobby, as John often says. A man is not much bigger than the thing that makes him angry. And we amateur radio operators, let me drop this. We've got a friendly enough hobby where we can have real calm personality when we're doing it. The magic is there, the magic of radio. That signal goes everywhere, and you can't stop it from doing it. And if you put 3 chambers together, one inside of another, $63 million per chamber, you wouldn't come close to making the amount of loss that Mother Nature does with, all she's got to do is 110 astronomical units, 10.30 billion miles. We'll do that for you. Over to you, John. KC2WGB. I'm taking big numbers today. K2RW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, it brings to mind that Joe Taylor. He's really invading everybody's privacy because you can't shield anything out. With his techniques, you can get more and more through anything. Good stuff. I'd like to thank everybody for joining the TechNet tonight and sending in the questions and everybody's participation. It's a lot of fun. And yeah, it's a hobby. Enjoy it, and if all goes well, we shall return next week. Unless that Planet 9 gets us, I don't know. That's up to Paul. I'll turn it over to Paul. You can say a few words. KC2WGB clear.
I think they're going to find that planet someday soon. But I think, you know, going by what Dick just said about Voyager, I'm thinking 5 times the diameter of the Earth every hour, both those spacecraft are moving away from us. You know, just to make a contact, you know, one end of the Earth to the other, you know. We go around the globe, bouncing off the ionosphere and all. This thing's a direct shot all the way past Pluto, 3 or 4 times past Pluto. And still moving away, 5 times the diameter of the Earth every hour. Wow. We'll see you next week. Back to you, Dick. 73, John.
All you can say about that space plant, that spacecraft, boy, it's way out there. Way out, man. Bye-bye, you all.
Well, the conspiracy people probably have something to say that we've never really sent it out there and that we're faking all those signals. I don't know. Have fun, people, and enjoy. KC2WGB clear.
8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting.